Welcome to Hashtag with Navguzi Chiwanuka. This is a place where we help you unravel social constructs, discuss self-development in line with mental health, emotional well-being, and everything in between that directly or indirectly affects us in the millennial world around us. If you're hearing my voice for the first time and are the kind of person who is not scared of being a better version of yourself, even if it requires you to contradict who you were 24 hours ago, consider this your virtual home. I'm your host, Navguzi Chiwanuka, and I cannot wait to engage with you in the various conversations. This 100th episode is one of its kind. In it, I bring you a summary of the podcast live recording event we had on Women's Day. The event was, or still is, one of the efforts made to make sure that women's voices are amplified on online spaces. If it wasn't for MCI Radio, you wouldn't have an idea of what transpired that day. So, thanks to the team's effort that this comes to you as the 100th episode. Let's dive into it.
Yeah, naturally, I'm a really shy person in person. When I'm behind, when I'm in studio, one-on-one guests, I'm very okay, very confident. I make noise, but being here now, So welcome to How Digitally Fit Are You? I shared the idea with most of the people that got the invite digitally and concepts that have been shared online, that is, on my online platforms. My name, for those that have never seen me, my name is Navguzi Chiwanuka, and I'm the podcast host of Hashtag with Navguzi Chiwanuka. On the platform, we normalize conversations related to mental health and everything related to those things that may make it hard for a millennial to thrive in life. So we have those conversations there. We have them with Ugandans, Kenyans, and every other person, as long as it's an African, because we want to make this a normal thing on the continent. So today we're going to be in line with the Women's Day theme, that is digital, and it's related to making innovation and technology as a tool to make gender equality achievable. So on the panel, we're having Bobina Zofa from Policy. These people really sponsored this event. They've made it possible for us to be here. MCI also made it very possible. This is where we are. MCI Radio is also here with us, and they're streaming us live to various people that are listening into the radio. So what we are going to do is we shall have the other panelists join us a little later. He's held up, but we're going to start with Bobina, who is available, and she can introduce herself. I'm seeing her for the very first time, so she can introduce herself. She's going to tell us about what Policy is after, and we shall start the conversation from there.
Hi everyone, I'm called Bobina Zofa, and I'm a data and digital rights researcher at Policy. Policy is a civic technology organization. We're based in Kampala and Bugulawi, but we work across much of the sub-Saharan, but also global south, really. And I'd say our biggest offering is the research that we do at the intersection of data, tech, and society. And a lot of that research is translated into, you know, programs and advocacy programs, mostly with our feminist movement building team who have made this happen. Yeah, that's just a really brief overview of myself and the work that I do with Policy and what Policy is doing, but I am happy to share more around the work we're doing in relation to the overall theme. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's after.
Thank you so much. So what we are doing today, when you talk about digital, we are making sure that everyone, regardless of their gender, they can access these digital platforms. And the main thing that we're going to be talking about today is how online gender-based violence makes this hard. So we're going to hear from Bobina. When we talk about online gender-based violence, there are some people, we know, when you looked at the form, there are some people that had no single idea of what that is. And yet these are things that happen day in, day out. So would you highlight that bit for us on online gender-based violence, and also probably why you feel like people may not have an awareness of what it is, yet it's very common?
So as Policy, I'd say we've done enough work around online gender-based violence across a number of countries, both Francophone and Anglophone here in Africa. And I just want to very quickly mention from like the larger theme, which is innovation, tech, and gender equality. I'd say as Policy, we basically working at the intersection of tech and data and society, a lot of what we do really does look at the impact of, you know, the different innovations that are coming up. It could be the internet, it could be social media, it could be AI systems. We're really looking at the tech innovation space as a whole, and we're more focused with the digital rights part of that. So what's the impact of these technologies, particularly on African women, being a African civic technology, a feminist collective as well? We use feminist theories to dissect these issues and try to make sense of them and try to come up with a number of recommendations. So just moving to the online gender-based violence as a thing itself, my colleague Bonita Nyamere, I don't know if some of you know her, has done a lot of work around this. She's been leading much of our research around the area of online gender-based violence, with our most recent report being a report called A Dark Place for Women Journalists. So I'd say, like, in very simple terms, just think about, I would assume everyone in this room or listeners of the podcast know what, you know, gender-based violence is, you know, which is violence which could be sexual or physical or any sort of violence that women get to face in the physical world. So what we see is this is now happening in the virtual space as well, on the digital spaces. And so in very simple terms, that is what online gender-based violence is, you know, women facing this violence on online spaces. And I don't know if you want me to just go a little past that. I just wanted to quickly point out that this violence takes the form of, it could be misogynistic hate speech, it could be sexist comments, body shaming, you know, and this extends sometimes, as we see, from even the online spaces to the offline spaces, where, you know, some people's families and friends, you know, end up getting attacked from comments that they were initially receiving from online, and they're translated to the physical spaces as well of their lives. So I'd say, like, that's sort of an overview of what online gender-based violence is. And I'd say in Africa here, from the research that we've done, the people that are facing this the most are women journalists, women human rights defenders, and politicians, compared to, you know, other groups of people. But those are people that are really getting, you know, the worst of it in online spaces.
When you mentioned the part where they are the most targeted, I think it's important for us to also highlight what the cause might be. Is it because they are easily accessed, or are they putting themselves so much out there, as opposed to someone who might really be at the back end, you know, someone who is just, like, I would say, a visitor online? They're very occasional.
Definitely. But I think, again, like I said, using the feminist theories, one of the things that we found is generally, from what was happening in the physical world or what continues to happen today, is women predominantly have been told to live in the private spaces and men live in the public space. It's their world, really. So as a woman coming into a public space, it's already cause for, you know, expect whatever is coming your way just because you're a woman and you're breaking out of a space that society has built for you. And that has to do with the patriarchal system that we live in today, because it's, you know, it's been constructed that way. So I would say that's one of the reasons that we see that happening on online spaces as well, because the online space has something that started out as something that was meant to be a democratic space, a space for everyone to, you know, come and freely express themselves. And now we see what was happening on the offline world being translated into the virtual world as well, where now, again, the virtual is a male space, and women coming into the space is like, how dare you? You're breaking the norm. So it has to do with the culture norms, our perceptions of these spaces, you know, that we occupy as men and women, very much so. But there is, of course, a number of other reasons, you know. It's why you're talking politics as a woman. If I feel negatively about your opinions as a woman, you're most likely to get, like, all this. I mean, it's not to say that the other gender or the other genders are not getting this backlash for their opinions. They still are. But we see that online gender-based violence is much more skewed towards women than men, and the data is there to support that.
It's very important that you've highlighted the bit of the other gender also facing that rough patch. And it reminded me of someone that I was having a conversation with prior to today, and he said that he was managing a politician's social media, I think Twitter, and the messages that were coming in the inbox, he couldn't believe it. He was like, yo, women face this? So I think it's very important that you highlighted that bit where, yes, it happens both sides, but the women get it more. So can we hear from Mr. Abbas? You missed out on the introduction, so it's important for the people to know that you're one of the panelists.
I am. hello, everyone. How are you doing? Welcome. My name is Abbas Mpindi. I work here at MCI. I am the CEO. It's a pleasure to be here. Yeah. Thanks for hosting me.
Sure. Thank you for honoring the invite. At least talk about what MCI...
What MCI does?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
For people to have an idea, because some are here for the first time.
Yes. So our work is essentially training young journalists. We say we're building the next generation of journalists. That's the buzzword. We started by just organizing competitions and bringing young journalists closer to opportunities. And now we have transitioned to creating a space that allows, you know, amplifying media innovations. In essence, the work hasn't changed. We still train and work with young journalists, only that now the idea of creating a space for innovators in the media landscape is an addition. So, yeah.
I am one of those innovators, guys. Yeah. I was privileged to be one of the people that were pioneers of the podcast training under MCI, so truly honored to be here. So, based on what Bobina shared, I don't know if you had, but at some point when you're around, she highlighted the bit of journalists being a target. The main target when it comes to women. Yes, online gender-based violence happens to other people, but then there are specific groups of women that are targeted, and journalists are one of those that have been trained. Is there something, when it comes to the training, is this something that you've considered when training the young journalists?
So the role of journalism in this space and in this conversation is really, really important. And first of all, it's to look at how journalists are in themselves covering these issues. But the first thing to talk about, like, how are journalists being attacked? So not just online, but even in their newsrooms. So, and those attacks could be, you know, emotional attacks on someone's capacity to produce or to work because they are a woman. Or it could be, you know, sexual harassment in the newsroom and online as well. So we know as an organization that works with young people that people come back and say, you know what, I would have loved to stay in the media, but it's not for me. And it's painful to see someone who had the passion to work in the media, to tell stories, say they would rather now go into communication. And the reasons are things that could be avoided, but it's hard because some of it, like she was saying, is really intrinsic into how people behave and you know, the traditions of a patriarchal society. Yeah.
So is there a moment in your trainings or even the journalists that you have you had that those kinds of reports to you before?
So for our training, we have safety and security for journalists, and it just targets every aspect of how, what do you need as a journalist to be safe, whether you're, you know, man or woman. But of course, what we also have added now is a component of mentorship, and we have a lot of female mentors who go through these experiences and are able to talk to the young journalists and say, this is the field you're coming in, and this is how things look like, and the support system you need in place. I was in Kenya. One of the things that we're trying to pitch now is the idea of, you know, promoting leadership, newsroom leadership for women. And as an organization, again, which is like a whole lot of male-led, we are asking ourselves if we are the right people to do it, maybe partnerships with other organizations that are working on that. But newsroom leaders who are women play a crucial role in terms of mentoring the next generation of women leaders in the newsroom, creating an environment within the newsroom that allows, you know, women to thrive, and also putting in place online either policies or platforms that safeguard. We hope that it goes through. But we also do gender-sensitive reporting training with other partners for journalists to learn how to, one, report about the importance and relevance of things like gender equality. Our fellowship is not just media and skills training. It has a big component on social justice journalism and leadership for journalists. And that includes, you know, roundtable conversations between male and female fellows about the stereotypes. So we have an exercise where you talk about the stereotypes you hear, and we're able to really debunk them and see most of the young, even young men in the fellowship, by the time they leave the fellowship, their mindset and their thinking, which was previously probably very traditional, begins to be challenged. And then also for the space, the young women are also to be able to, you know, speak up and say, oh, all along, that's what you were doing. Yeah. So those are some of the ideas we, you know, ways we try to make sure that it's the conversations are ongoing. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Back to Bobina. When you talked about the patriarchal system being one of the reasons that, you know, keep this ground very fertile for online-based gender violence, what are the specific ways you feel like a woman, when it comes to online gender-based violence, how best can they protect themselves?
Okay, I'm probably not the best person to talk about this because I'm not a cybersecurity expert, but I do know from some of the trainings we do at Policy or from some of our recommendations in the research reports we put out along gender-based violence. I think we try to like map out a sort of multi-stakeholder approach to this because there is like no one group that can just dismantle this system that has been in place for so long. So there is different roles to be played by different people or stakeholders. So of course, as an individual, say, being a woman journalist, it serves you to have the capacity to be able to protect yourself online. So that comes with the digital security training. I mean, he mentioned how they're doing some of that. I know a lot of newsrooms right now are doing, I know with the Future of Work project, with a lot of the people we've been partnering with, that's been a big element, cybersecurity training, where they're told about all these, you know, the passwords, this and that, you know, block and all these, you know, like I said, I'm the expert, but there is like a whole range of, you know, the cybersecurity, how to, you know, protect yourself as a person online. But there is also a role to play, again, like you mentioned, like even within the newsrooms, so as the news editors or as the news house, is there a sort of policy brief, in-house policy brief that addresses these issues where, you know, it's something that's known to the journalists, so it's something they look out to. It could be government, you know, are they able to uphold the policies that are supposed to protect women on online spaces because it's their digital rights for them to not be silenced and thrive on online spaces? Is it the tech companies, big tech, do they have a role to play in the misinformation, disinformation, malinformation? They have a role to play as well in whether it's regulation and coming in to address where cyber harassment is happening on a large scale or something towards groups of women or something. So I think there is something to be done at different levels, and I think that's one of the best ways it could be approached, really. Yep.
Yeah, and what interested me most when it came to Policy is when I phoned the digital safety. I don't know if, are we all connected to the internet? Do you have internet activated on your phone? Could you take us through the digital safety platform?
Julie, I think she's the best suited to do that. Yeah.
I'm supposed to be in the background. Why are you bombarding me? Hi, everyone. So my name is Juliet Grace. I work at Policy as the community engagement lead. So we've created a game online because we understand that, like Bobina has been saying, we do a lot of research, but this interpretation of this research for different audiences, it's different. So you put out a research concept, and like, but you don't understand the language in which your research has been put out. But also I think for us, what we are doing with our research is we try to visualize it, and the digital safety game is one of the ways through which we've actually visualized our research. So when you go online, just type in digital safety, safe, the word safe, and then T, chikachai, that word. So you can play the game at your own time. And there are characters that we've developed that when you can choose a character that you can play as in that game. And there are different prompts through that game that will lead you to a different level. So if we are speaking about, Abbas, have you found it?
Yeah.
Have we found it? Okay, so when you go to the game, like, you choose a character. I think there's a Muslim lady who I love. So you choose a character that you want to be, and then there are prompts. So at different stages of the game, the prompts will sort of ask questions. So if you're online, how do you respond to an incident of harassment, such and such manners? It's a user-friendly game, if I might simply put. So again, research, simplify it in a manner that if it's prompts, whoever is
a part of these prompts is able to sort of find themselves within that game. But you're playing that game, you're enjoying it, but then you're also learning about a topic that you might not be paying attention to previously. Thanks for bombarding me.
You're welcome.
She just said you're welcome. So you can do that. Probably you'll be doing that in the network session. I would like to pass the microphone to the audience, and if anyone has a question to the panelists so that they can answer these questions.
Thank you so much. But one of the panelists mentioned that they use feminist theories. Would you mind telling us which ones exactly? Because we have the Afrocentric and the Eurocentric. Where do they meet and where do they merge? Do they speak to the Ugandan experience?
Very happy to take that question. So being a Ugandan, I'd say homegrown civic tech, a lot of the work we do is Afrofeminist in nature. So I'd say we draw a lot of our theories from Sylvia Tamale's work, who's Ugandan. So a lot of our theories speak to the realities of African women, of Ugandan women. Yeah.
My interpretation of the digital world is it's a virtual space where there are not so many rules and where people can say anything and get away with it, where anybody can put a face to anything and, you know, so it's hard to have checks and balances. So for somebody who is online in a world that is virtual and not really censored, how do you really protect yourself, whether as a woman or as a man? Because if, for example, you put something online, it could be a happy moment and then people will come in and it ends up affecting your mental health. One comment like this can really almost lead you to suicide sometimes. So how best do you think you can really guard yourself given the nature of the online world?
I'll just say something very small and pass it over, because I'm sure he has more to say about this. But I'd say, like, I do get the feeling of, you know, from your description, you know, the internet or this virtual space feels like some wild, wild west with no rules and whatnot. Yeah. But in essence, I'd say from, like, maybe the beginning of a lot of, say, social media at the time, there's been very limited regulation. But I personally believe greatest change can come from system changes, if the overall system changes from what it is right now. So it's the different people that I talked about that have a different role to play to alter this system. And this is something that is, you know, I feel like in many ways we're sort of playing catch up, for example, with regulation of technologies, tech policy. Tech policy is very slow. You're seeing with a lot of emerging technologies, we're just playing catch up. But I don't know. I don't personally like the response of be a more resilient person, but unfortunately, it's like, if, so for example, with the program that we've been doing with a number of, I think, women leaders, MPs and whatnot, I think one of the things is that came from the amplified report abuse we did on politicians around the election in 2021 was these people are being, you know, abused and a lot of them went silent. They got off these social media platforms. But then it's like, well, it works against you to be offline, because as a woman politician, you might as well be on this space because it serves you to put yourself out, people to get to know your ethos, what is it you're trying to do for them. So it's a disservice to be silenced. So it's like, maybe sometimes it's like, well, try and be resilient. But I personally don't like that response. That's why I personally would like the, it seems like a slower process, but system changes, I believe, would be the most efficient in just addressing this entire system that's sort of a mess right now.
So, you know, this Ghanaian song, I think, says if anyone is stressed this year, I will delete them and and block them. Yes. So me, I go for that radical part of like block, delete. But I think there are different levels. There are people who are big tech that are doing the work. And I think policy is also doing the work of training people and exposing them to different tools to protect themselves. Digital safety, like that one. Please access it and use it so that you can know, like, how do you create all these, you know, passwords and things like that. I set a limit for myself in terms of, for example, from a news consumption, if I start from there, I know what, like during the COVID lockdown or 19, that was just a lot for people taking, and we are saying, please have a news consumption limit, right? So that if you watch TV for a specific period of time and know, like, you know what, I've just been seeing dead bodies and now, like, numbers of people, and it's affecting you. And it's the same with social media. The thing that recently I was looking at, my phone now can give me, I guess maybe it's a cool phone, but the phones now can give you like the number of hours you've spent on different platforms. So, and I was looking at the number of hours I spent on WhatsApp, to be honest, and it looked like I've not been working at all. It's like 26 hours in a week. And it could be that I'm working, right? But that time that you spend there is also the time that exposes you to different, you know, online, you know, people are talking about clickbaits, who is sending you what kind of information. So I know my limit in terms of consumption. Then even on the different platforms for you, knowing, are you an influencer? Yeah, if you're not an influencer, then... Because sometimes there are people that send you requests, to be honest, and you've never met, right? And you know this is not going to end well. And of course, there are all these privacy tools on the different social media platforms that you can go into to safeguard yourself from receiving certain information from people you don't know, from having certain comments on your photos. And because there are people that you want to even just reshare their post, and you can't because they've put those privacy settings. I mean, those are really basic. The guys that policy have more intricate tools that you can use or go into. And if the worst gets to the worst, don't be resilient. Just take a social media break. The best time I've enjoyed sometimes is when I've lost my phone. And at the beginning, it's like too much to be there without a phone. But then you realize after, if you spent a week without a phone, there's some sort of going back to old school, right? That you are just, you're okay, right? So maybe you need that as well so that you don't have to be online all the time if it's getting there. Yeah. Mine are not really technical. They're just simple tools.
Now that you ask whether she was an influencer, had I been the person to ask, what advice do you give me?
Are you an influencer?
I am. What are you talking about?
Yeah. Influencers, I think you still have tools to... I think there are now even language filters where you can say, okay, this is comments that should not come to my inbox. So I think for me, those are really basic in terms of privacy settings, but I don't think that's pretty enough for you as an influencer, because you every day, if you have followers, you're always adding numbers, numbers, numbers. Maybe you need her advice of resilience to build your, you know, your... One of the other things, what for me, I like to do digital literacy for at least... to have conversations with other people, you know, as a man, to have conversation with, you know, other men, young men that we mentor here, because the tools they are using them, and maybe whatever they're doing in those inboxes and comments, maybe they are not aware where it comes from, right? And so we are not talking about what they're sending. We're talking about like what gets you to behave like that, right? And I realize there are tools online, but there's also, let's go back old school and create spaces where we can have conversations of why we should be just good human beings, right? When I was starting my career, we used to go to the universities and like even high school to train people about making smart choices. And some of the conversations really had to do with all these things. But at the end of the day, we do the things we do because there's a certain way we are behaving online. And it's the same way we behave in physical spaces. If I can, on a virtual platform, make sexist comments, it's very clear that even in daily life, I will do it. I'm not hiding. There's some people who will hide behind other faces or other, you know, other handles that are not theirs, especially if they want to attack someone and they don't want to, like, anonymous. But if that person is doing it online, they definitely do it in real life. And what we've lost is continuous engagement in physical spaces to challenge each other and to be able to say, because when we talk about fake news and how to stop it, and we tell people before you click or share, please think 3 steps. But in real life, we also tell people filter, right? filter. Just think about it. Just think about it before you actually speak something that you know will be insulting or dangerous to the other person. And for me, it's just the humanity that we need to be able to bring from physical spaces to bring it online. So it can be policy work, just it can't be MCI work. Even organizations that are working on daily working with young men and young women, these conversations need to happen, because there is nothing that is virtual that is not happening in the physical spaces. If a woman puts, you know, they are at the swimming pool and they maybe post a picture when they are swimming or at the beach, if I can comment sexist comment there, it means if I was at Gaba Beach, I would do the same, right? It hasn't changed really. I didn't give you the influencer response. Be resilient. As an influencer, I think you need more. I think influencers need really more digital safety and security training. And you should invest more money into not getting the basic toolkits that we get, but real hardcore trainings, because that's where you are earning money. That's where you spend, like, almost, you know, your whole life there in that space. And that's like, it's like if I wasn't, this is my influencer space, right? If I wasn't keeping this, I do each and every day an extra step to make sure it's safe for me and for everyone else. So I think influence the same way.
So when we talk about people that are working online, you realize that some online spaces or virtual spaces become property, or digital spaces become property to some individuals. And when Abbas was speaking, I remembered a Kenyan lady who had a YouTube channel with so many followers. And the moment, I don't know if the boyfriend had her password, but when they broke up, he deleted all the content. And she could no longer access the platform, so she had to start afresh. And that for me, I think when I see some of these people talking about sharing, you have to share passwords and things like that. And I remember I had to think about the podcast that I have. And I was like, hey, no one is supposed to have anything related to my work or even my platforms, because now my social media may not just be for fun or anything. There is more to it that happens. So to add on to what they have mentioned, personally, what I do is just keep in check of, I might not have control of the people coming to my space, because sometimes some people come through the podcast or someone has shared something about you. But it's also important to check the people that send your friend requests. Sometimes I don't have time. It takes a lot of energy to study every other person's account. Now, when someone sends me a friend request, they don't have a profile picture or they don't have a real identity. They have locked their profile. What do you mean? I don't know you. You've locked your account. How am I supposed to assess you? We need to start assessing people before allowing them into the spaces. Because if you're talking about, even like he's mentioned, even names. There's some people in my that I wanted to even highlight on my friend list. Like, you guys are so lucky to be in my space because you don't have real names. Because I don't do that. I want a real name. Someone sends you a friend request under Bidi Abidi Mwabidi. You know? And so how am I going to respond? You're going to comment on my post and I'm going to say, bidi abidi mwabidi chino chechigenda maso. It doesn't make sense for me, because when I relate with people online, I want to relate with them the way I relate with them in real life. There are people that say, don't take social media serious. But some people live their lives there. So do everything that you need to take care of your spaces. You own a business online. Please use Policies Digital Safety. It's going to share with you insights on how to protect yourself online.
Hello. Thank you for the knowledge you've given us so far. My question is regards to research. You talked about politicians and media personalities. However, with the way that technology has impacted the society, and you have kids and school-going children, with on social media, in your research, do you do such research when it comes to schools and the impact of online gender-based violence in schools? And what has been your finding in regards to that?
That's a very interesting question. So we do not have something published yet on that, but we've done work on minors. We have a report in the works called Gen Z, where we look at the internet usage patterns of the so-called digital natives, the young people born in the digital era. So from the research we have so far, yes, they do experience a lot of online gender-based violence. A lot of them have, you know, talked about the same things that have been happening, the negative comments, the sexist comments and whatnot. So we haven't, because we don't have the work ready to get out to the public, I can't quantify it for you and tell you it's a bigger problem than, say, for example, for human rights defenders or for journalists, but it's an equally bigger problem for that, especially being people who are constantly on online spaces, even way more than the older people, especially here across the continent. From the at least data we have, it is a problem. The minors are complaining about that as well.
Maybe to just add on that, we have a program here called Media Literacy for Kids, and Tracy and other people here are trainers. And the rationale was to train kids between, I think, 5, 7, and then 10 to 12 or 10 to 14, how the media works, right? And when we talk about media, we didn't say journalism. We talked about, you know, how is media created? Who is behind, you know, movies you watch? What do you see online? So we do have here at MCI a curriculum to train parents, teachers, and kids themselves. And then we had an event here where one person who works with the Children's Authority, I think, if I remember very well. And they have all these cases of kids, teenage girls or kids who are befriended by old men online. So there's this one case, this person pretended to be a young, and it's like age mate, and they were chatting for a very long time. And so this girl maybe thinks, oh, this is a cool person, and then they invite this guy to the home. This guy abducts this kid. But it all started on Facebook. So there was a whole, how people are using online platforms, especially to, you know, kidnap children. And as you know for sure, a lot of our siblings, young, they're already on Facebook, right? They have access to these platforms. So there is also need, and I'm glad you guys are doing this, there's need to equip that generation as well with that awareness, right? Because people just reach out and make all these promises and they turn out to be an old person, an old man trying to... And I didn't want to finish the story, but it has a nasty ending. And after that story, everyone was like, well, things are really bad. Again, like I said, the same people that would do that in real life would do the same online. So,
you know, when you mentioned the part of the children being kidnapped, even adults, you need to take precautions when dealing with people, especially people that you don't know. People see you online and instantly they feel like they own you. DMs are dangerous, man. There's a person who texted me towards midnight and I was like, oh, the audacity, yeah? And then, so I opened the message and ignored it, like, just show him, yeah, I've seen the message, but I'm not responding. Then early in the morning, he sent another message. He was like, come on, don't be mean. I'm just a fan. Let me give you time, maybe you're busy. I archived the chat and silenced it. I'm not going to be notified when he texts. Or some, I do them a favor. I help them not to feel like I'm rude or not to feel attacked. I help them by blocking them in Messenger so that you can't text me anymore. People just want to own you. They don't know you, but they're going to own you. So in every way, don't leave these spaces. You need to be on these digital platforms. So
the majority of the Q&A session was edited out because the conversation kind of veered off the day's theme.
What you need to understand is that you, all human beings, you have biases. And as we have our biases, those biases can creep into our stories, especially if we are writers, we are communicators. So you can tell certain biases in what story you're reading. So you're saying some stories are subjective, right? There's a reason why you're saying that, because you've sensed a certain tone, you've sensed a certain maybe bias, right? And it's not just on covering that line of stories, it's just across. So you can tell who has gender bias, if that person has a bias on women and the stories they tell. So journalists are trained to make sure that, you know, if you're covering now, there's a big emphasis on making sure that you have, you know, women experts in your story. Because in most of the stories you read or see, the experts are always men. So, yeah? His. And when it comes to the victim, so it's very natural for a male journalist or even a female journalist to be at a source, as a space where there is maybe, you know, you can get a voice of the expert and also the voice of someone in the community. So there is always high chances that you will find voice of someone who has struggled. You'll go for the woman, of course, depending on the context. It also has to do with the whole, you know, structure of the economy. Who is employed where? Once you asked for, we want experts on climate change, there's probably going to be 100 men who are over there. So Andrew won't have a choice but to interview those guys. But Andrew could do an extra, you know, to say, but okay, it's 100 men, but there must be someone, right? And maybe there's, you know, that woman that someone didn't know about because we have not been documenting them over the years. And the reason why we have all these men is because we've documented them many, many years, and so they are known. So the other people that we say, oh, they are not there, they are there, but we've never focused on them. And if we put them up there, so it's the same. So you'll see those biases. So I can tell if you have a bias against, let's say, a certain tribe, by the way you present, the way you talk about them, if you're on radio, on TV. So the biases are there. That's why you're saying it's subjective. Does that make sense?
Okay. Good. Hello.
Hey, hi.
My name is Andrew Kagwa Maiga.
Hi, Andrew.
Hi. I'm a journalist. One, about the whole subjective, because it's not the very first thing I wanted to talk about, but I've been lucky enough to work under female editors my entire life. And it has always been very deliberate that you need a female voice when you're putting together a story. And I hate sharing this story, but it's something that happened. There was that whole saga when people wanted to demolish the National Theater. I'm an arts and culture reporter.
Which?
So there was a time they wanted to either demolish, redevelop. They were using very many terms that were very unclear. So I was very vocal online about the whole thing. We started a campaign where we printed a couple of t-shirts of Save the National Theater and everything. So the minister that time was the Minister of Gender, because Art and Culture simply under that. It's not really a department, it's a desk. So, like, I shared you an interview with her, and then she first hesitates to give it a yes, but then eventually says yes. So I turn up for this interview, and I'm ready to fire away, and she's like, oh, first wait. And in no time, like, men come and now sit around her. That one of them was, I think, and other men I didn't know much about. So I start asking her questions, and whenever I would ask a question, like, they would bounce it off each other, and then by the time it gets to her, it's either useless. So I noticed that she was technically avoiding to be the source by fronting these men. So I started firing the men direct, and I remember the end of that whole interview was when was like, so do you still stay in Perere? And, well, that threw me off. That interview never ran, like, it didn't run, because after that, everything about that interview went upside down. But my point is, at times, actually, people try their level best to include everyone when they're interviewing, but you're going to find someone that will be like, I need you to withhold everything I told you. I don't know if my husband will be okay with this coming out.
Okay, last question to Mrs. Bobina. I wanted to know.
Okay. Miss, you can just call me Bobina.
Yep. Okay, Bobina. Okay. I want to know, there is an issue arising when it comes to property, especially in marriages. And such things escalate onto online social media. And have you done research in line with that? How property is affecting online gender-based violence in a way?
No, it's not something I can speak to. We have done work on online gender-based violence as a whole. So there is a number of things that come up as core themes. So for example, gender is one of the things that starts a lot of online gender-based violence. The conversation around gender itself, politics, etc. But that's interesting. I didn't know about, I see that on online spaces, but I didn't know it was, what extent it's a problem. So I can't really speak to that. Until we focus a lot on the data element of how that's impacting societies. But yeah,
good afternoon to you all. Avas say that they have a program which can help the young ones with the media. But then when I look at it, there are some of us who have just dived in, because it wasn't our thing, we have just entered into your era. Then there are some others who are in your age, but they are in between there. You can find somebody who doesn't even know how to write, but she has a digital, and she doesn't know how to manage it. And whatever she shares, it's not easy for her or him to filter. Then when you come to organizations, many of us are using digital, either in our kind of work, either looking for jobs. I'm not from the journalist side, but then there are things you look at and you see that this is a person, I think, who really doesn't know much about the digital. So I'm wondering, with the policy, is there in any way how you can help certain organizations if they happen to contact you? Because me, I'm working with a research organization, but we seem to be elite, but when you go into digital, you find like we are half-baked. So I don't know how we can be helped. Then too, as mothers or grandmothers, many of us may be having those young ones. How can we approach you so that those young ones are helped? As the lawyer said, many of them have been victimized. TikTok is the way. Once you see a WhatsApp, just know TikTok is on the way.
It's already there.
It's already there. Facebook is already there. It's not easy these days for a child or an adolescent of these days to talk about any program on the TV, because it's not their thing now. They would rather close themselves in the bedroom and they are on the phone throughout. So I'm just wondering, how can the children and the, can I call them innocent adults or green adults, be helped? Thank you very much.
Okay, so I'll start with green adults. So we have a media training program for NGOs, and the capacity building around it is how to communicate and tell your story better. So we will bring your team, take you to our studios, and ask you to tell your story about your work and your organization. And we'll have your team listen in and watch you. And then when we're done recording, we'll play it for you. The thing is to understand how to communicate and tell your story so that the people understand it better. But for that audience also, there's, you know, we have a digital skills training, especially based on the needs of the organization. So if you say social media tools and how to use it for your work, so that can be done at an institutional level. So we do those trainings. I don't know if there's anyone who has the power right now to fight TikTok, to be honest. It's scary because it's just, even the sound of TikTok, it's meant for kids. It's just like, TikTok, we're done. But what I think we have lost is transparency and I called friendship between and time between parents and children. And it's hard because, you know, you have a child and then you have to work all the time and you never get time to actually sit down and know, right? And for me, I think it's really important, even with the media literacy training, there is the component of parents understanding what content is my child consuming and being aware. It's not policing them, but having very candid conversations on why certain content should not be believed, or because at the end of the day, you don't want to police and take away the opportunity from this child to learn these tools, because on the other side, it's a powerful tool for that child to express themselves, to meet, could find opportunities, because there are very many things they can do there. But now it's really to help, you know, children understand how we do media literacy, the digital literacy for kids. I think UNICEF might have, I need to double check, is to help kids understand these tools better and how to use them for their own good. But the conversation has to be there. So if we're not talking to our kids, definitely we'll never know what content they're consuming. And if it's bad content, it could be pornographic content, they will never tell you, right? So it will just be always at the back with friends. So the first part is, you know, let's really create an environment where you are able to understand what content is being consumed in the house so that you can also find a way of supporting them. And then with the media literacy, if Navuguzi, for example, has the opportunity to prepare, we've had the reason for why it has not worked very successfully, it's really financial, but we've had to, for example, curate programs, holiday programs, where kids come in and get training. But it has not been very effective. What we want to be able to do is to work with even parents to say, how can we make sure these trainings are happening? We have the space, can come, the trainers are here. But at the grassroots level, I think for me, it's going to be hard to regulate these unless we talk to, which is not the best way to go, regulators around, you know, at that level. However, I think DSTV does a good job, which we can pick lessons from DSTV in terms of like parental guidance. I'm not a parent, so I don't have very good examples. But DSTV as a platform has parental guidance where you can safeguard. So it could be, I don't know how that sort of like example could apply on the online platforms. If is there Facebook for kids? Mm. But there's YouTube for kids, for example. I don't know for TikTok. I'm not a good user of that. So YouTube, for example, has, you know, you can set it up. I've seen even, you know, people who can afford Netflix now, but it's really hard. So the thing, I think for me, the best protection is this conversation, because that's the first line of defense, so that there is trust that my child can confidently come without fear of reprisal, you know. They know like the conversation is going to happen, and it's really based on what content are we consuming? Is it good for you? So media literacy, for example, we help them understand the thought process behind creating movies, so that when they see Superman, they can try it out. But please, don't do the other thing. Don't fly over from here, right? Because they need to know that there are stunts, there is safety already there. So if you try it at home, and that's really good, because then you see kids saying, so that's what happens. Okay, good, right? They get it. So we have one exercise called Media Machine, which you can also try. It's for them to understand how journalists create content. So we create a scene, like an accident, and some of the kids are policemen, others are journalists, others are news anchors, and they run through the scene. So the accident happens, the policeman calls the journalists run with their cameras, they cover it, they run to the editor's space, the editor says, oh yeah, this is good. Then they send it to the production room, the production kids are like working out, then it ends up with a news anchor. Then the news anchor airs it live, and then they're able to see themselves on the screen. And that experience, they never forget. So we find those sort of like role plays and tools to help them understand like what's behind, so that they can make even for them better decisions. The first part is, can your child make, you know, a decision for them to say, ah, that's not good content for me? You seem to have a, you know.
I was just saying that's really cool.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Thank you.
For me? Hello. No, just for you. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Shamim Nirere. I'm an educator. I would like to build on what you are saying. Part of what we do at Izere Education is we ask ourselves what skills should today's student be learning, and then we support schools and also run programs for that. Before I bring a proposal to run that program for you, I would like to just share that what he said is not sustainable to police children today, because children, for example, born after 2010, they're younger than 3D TV. It's not even their future, it's their now. Facebook is their past, it's for us adults, it's for us grown people, grandmothers. For them, yes. So it's their world.
I don't
to
like
them.
Your tone.
No, I've had teenagers like roll eyes on you like, you're on Facebook? No. So what I'm trying to say is that TikTok is there now, is there present. So what we do is, what I encourage parents to do is, like, let's get children to also be part of the people to create content, not just consume. Because children have amazing stories. The stories you tell your children as they go to bed, they can create so many stories, you know. So apart from just being consumers as a continent, they how create. Can we contribute to creating that content? And then we teach young people and children to be responsible online. One of the challenges right now, even as adults, is managing distractions. There's so much noise that even you as an adult, you fail to work because of notifications, because of TV. So there are some things you start with. For example, at home, you use one gadget at a time, even for children. You're either watching TV, and that's all. You can't be watching TV. You have a tab, you have a laptop open, you're doing homework, and you're eating food. That is recipe for disaster. One of the top skills that needed today is skills of focus. Even for us adults, we are struggling. So you begin small when they are young, and you teach them one gadget at a time and responsibility. When they're watching something, ask them, what is the PG? If something is PG-13, and my daughter is 10 years, she has no business watching that. In fact, she's the one who keeps checking and saying, ah, mommy, this is PG-11. And you know that it's really, really clean, it's really okay, but because you want to inculcate that skill of saying that I am 10 years, you have no business watching 13-year-old content, they're out. So it has grown and it has become, there's one time we were watching TV together and showed PG-18. It was just something on Noko TV, very clean. But I said, you know what, you can't watch this. I didn't watch. So with time, it has reached a point where she keeps saying, no, I can't watch this. That is more sustainable, because then they are going to regulate themselves. Even if you regulate and police so much, at school they are interacting with children whose parents maybe they don't care, and children are consuming adult content. So when they're in that environment, they are so fortified that they're going to say, no, I'm not going to watch that. So it is important what you're doing, getting children to actually be media savvy and know how the things are done. If a child, their favorite cartoon is something, and you ask them, if you are to recreate this script, or if you are to recreate this movie or this cartoon, how would you do it? And just listen and let them actually create if they can. You are creating that skill. Because the truth is, there are some influencers, most of them, teenage girls, who are earning 3 million. We don't earn that in offices. So it is their future. And they are going to earn so much money, but it's just a double-edged sword that our young people can get so many disruptive jobs that wouldn't have been there. They're getting so much money. Or they can just consume, and the algorithm set for Africa, you know the content they give us, just entertainment and nothing serious. So it's we have so much power, and for spaces like yours, you're doing a great job. Well, let's just to come and make that work happen. Don't struggle with parents. We have parents. We have communities. Let's run that for you.
Hey,
thank you.
Clap for her. Thank you. Yeah, you are good. Thank you. Did that help?
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay, good.
The gentlemen seem to be quiet, but they are in the room. any questions, observations?
I am here.
You're doing a good job, but I feel you need backup.
We don't like your tone. Andrew.
At least someone wish us a happy Women's Day. Huh?
Hi, everyone. I'm Mark Chris Kaizi. On behalf of the organizers, we apologize for not wishing you a happy Women's Day in advance. So, the conversation is really great, and I'm really happy that we're having this. And I'm really happy that there's a sort of intergenerational conversation that's going on. And that's something that's really important. So I'll go back to my role. To all the women, to all the girls, to all the ladies in the
field. That's your...
Hey! Let me wish you a very happy Women's Day. You are strong. You keep us going. And don't stop pushing those boundaries. And let's keep going. Thank you very much.
Tracy, do you want to know why men keep silent in conversations about gender?
I would really love. This is honest space. Yeah. So let's go. Let's hear it.
So gender and sexual harassment, I mean, especially sexual harassment, men will always keep quiet. And I think it's the same with when we talk about racism and white people. You just, there's always that silence. And sometimes it's like, what do I say, right? And I think that's why you've seen after, you know, decades of work around gender equality, now organizations like UN Women are beginning to say, you know what, we need now, you know, male inclusion in these discussions, because for some time, I think the men ran away for many, many reasons. But one of the things that I know for sure is that when we have had conversations where we're talking about gender, or, you know, gender and sexual violence, men are always silent. And even like the fault of us as people who invite, you fault yourself, you find that all your invited guests are women. I don't know. I'm not saying you today, but they are. We just need to be aware. And I think for us who work in the media space, it's... when we create spaces and conversations like this, even how do we get men to feel like they have a role to play and a conversation to have, and not coming into the space from already feeling guilty. And even I think on the other side, like panelists and moderators, sometimes we are not very kind to the men in the audience if they say something that we don't believe in, right? So we had one session here where one of the students said, I want to advocate for the boy child, right? And one of the panelists like just went, ripped this kid apart. This kid is at the university, and of course you expect university. But the idea is, yes, we want, like if you're a feminist and maybe you don't agree with this thing where people say the boy child has been left behind, but what's the best way to have this conversation without making the other person feel like you are useless and you shouldn't be talking and this is not your place to be? And that, I think, sort of, there are other reasons, but one of the, I was just wanting to share that. I don't know, sir. Did I represent us well or not?
Hello, my name is Herbert. I do agree with, your name means Abbas.
Herbert Abbas, you know, we're good.
So often spaces such as these are confrontational in nature. They tend to point fingers, they tend to find fault. So it's sometimes hard for us to come into... I had mixed thoughts about coming here, but then because circumstances brought me here, right? But I think it's pleasant for me and for other people out there that we do have more of such conversations and spaces, because they are learning curves for us, yeah? Sometimes you find yourself engaged in a practice that, because you've not been told about it, you're continuously doing it without the background knowledge that it's probably affecting someone. For instance, body shaming, right? Our community is big on subconsciously body shaming women.
Man or woman?
Man, but mostly women, yeah.
Gundi or gaze?
Yeah, when you come into spaces like this, it's an opportunity for you to listen to persons who have been affected by gender-based violence on digital platforms. So for me, I think if we could have more of the same, we would appreciate it. I think it's largely an information gap that we need to cover. Yeah, thank you.
And you know, one of the things that I realize we never think about, so a concept like body shaming, if you think about it, maybe 20 years or 30 years ago, where people would just celebrate, you know, there was no conversation about weight, like you've gained weight, everyone would be like, yo, African mama. And that's like, you know, and even as a man, you know, you would just, when people said, what's your definition of beauty, right? Your brain and the way it was structured was always the curved. So there was never this thing, you couldn't trace it. Until now, recently, now it has become a huge conversation. And again, when you talk to, like, I share this story. I used to work with a fellowship program. So we used to pair one American and one Ugandan, two fellows. They would work together in an organization. So this one guy from Rwanda, he started to just send unsolicited messages to the female American co-fellow. And the female came and reported to the administrators and said, my co-fellow, this person that I work with, is sexually harassing me. And so we said, oh my God, what is happening here? What did he do? And then we brought them together. And we asked the guy, and the guy was like, what? Sexual harassment? I didn't even touch. I just to text, and for him he became very rowdy. He just was shouting at everyone. He's like, no, there's nothing you're going to tell me. And when you sit back and argue with this kind of person, you realize there's a history that gives them this sort of like thinking that there's nothing wrong they've done. And you know, when you're having conversations that could change mindset with this kind of person, you have to think about where, you know, the history, where this person has come from, their values, their beliefs, and that's how now that conversation is going to go. Because if you want to prove to him that he's wrong, in his mind it's just going, and it took time for him at the end of the fellowship, after very many conversations that would happen through spaces where the women would share what they're going through within the community, then he would get to say, okay. So for him, sending messages is his right. That's what he thinks. So there's not, turn out your number, right? This kind of thing. So it's the same, like, there are people that you talk to and they just keep commenting on weight, on bodies, and even when you say, but that's wrong, they say, go away, right? And that go away seems like, but it's, yeah? So we need also, like, and I think the researchers need to feed into these historical context to explain, like, where some of these things, you know, come from, especially with spaces that are getting to have more of this conversation. And transitions from a patriarchal, traditional society into now a more inclusive society takes, you know, that time. So
thank you so much for engaging with us. Bobina wants to say her last words. She's run out of time, so let's give our audience, then we shall carry this on.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for having us be a part of this. I unfortunately won't be able to, you know, talk over cocktails, but please reach out to me if you'd like to talk about any of the work we're doing as policy, or to reach out at policy as an organization. Reach out to us. We're open door policy, really, so we're happy to do the work together. I guess just before I leave, I'd like to say the reason these spaces feel confrontational is because the gender equality has to do with a power imbalance. So the power has been tilted towards one end for so long. And so I would actually like to, personally, my final remarks to just say, for the conversations that we're having, like he pointed out, to be able to come in spaces like this and talk about things like gender, body shaming, etc. It's because of the work of feminists who have been, you know, talking about these issues for a while, and now they're becoming more mainstream, which is great. And it's, I think, just really amazing to know that this could be carried on, and, you know, our societies could be more inclusive, and just people could live freely, you know, the way they would like to, without all these stereotypes and just all this, the burdens that, you know, women have had to bear so long because of the way our society has been set up for so long. And so, happy Women's Day to all of you. Happy Women's Day to the women doing the great work. Happy Women's Day to the people that are doing the work to make our world a better place for everyone, for all humans. And yeah, it's really amazing to meet you all, and great conversation. Great meeting you, Abbas. Great meeting you as well. I'm sorry, I have a problem pronouncing it. Nabuguzi. My bad. But no, thank you very much for having me here, having us, our policy, be a part of this.
Thank you so much for being around. So I think, I don't know if there is any other person who wants to share something, or maybe we should just break out into the networking session and, yeah, drinks. He has found it important for me to highlight that. Is there any other person who wants to share something, ask something?
Hi, everyone. So my name is Tracy. I feel like when it comes to gender and the very deeply entrenched connotations that come with it and the power imbalances that come with it, we often forget the cultural aspects, the norms. Where we come from. These do not just start today when you have Twitter and you have your TikToks. These start from when we were young. You have a neighbor, an uncle, who's like, "Ragundia geze," you know? And it's, you sweep it. It's okay. It's no more. You know, you're growing up. And then it grows. But you see, the boy had that. You had that. Your mom didn't say anything. You didn't say anything. The boy, your cousin had it. We kept quiet. You grow. You reach school. Ah, that chick is a tomboy. Yeah? Do you see? Like, she's not like a girl. So those things, we say them. The kids pick it up. They are innocent. Right now, there are statements that you will say around, for example, my daughter, and she'll be like, "You're rude. You're rude. You just can't call anyone anything. You can't body shame." And she has put this at the back of their mind, right? But as parents, as guardians, as friends, as cousins, there are these things that, you know, you notice even around kids. This and this. And they say them, but they got it from you. They got it from Auntie so-and-so. I think we need to shift, but shift from the grass. Roots. You know that saying of the, I can't say it in my language, you won't even understand it, but a stick is bent when it's still? Yeah, that one. I don't know, if I said it, you wouldn't understand, but you need to bend the stick while it's still young, because once we are grown and we have our accounts, you really can't mess with me. That's what I want to say, and that's it. That's I'm going to say it. But let's start now. And then probably the next generation will be a little bit more equitable and more sensitive. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for being around. I had the program lined out, and we were supposed to have a mental health professional on the panel. But unfortunately, she had to cancel at the last minute. So we agreed that we are going to do a recording. It's not going to be live like this, but we shall have a recording. If you have any questions, you can send them through of these conversations that we've had in terms of online gender-based violence, how best you can help yourself mentally to, you know, build the resilience that was shut down. But do share the questions. She's going to be able to answer them. It will come out after this session that we've had. Thank you so much. We are now ready to network. There is something to eat at the back and something to drink.
The event was hugely sponsored by the Media Challenge Initiative. In my deepest of fears and doubts, these people assured me that the event could happen. Policy equally made sure that while we were having a transformational conversation, it would be kind for our attendees to network over some bites and drinks. Mm-hmm. To the individuals that worked heavily to make this day possible, Simon Kakoza of the Media Challenge Initiative, Odwo Jogero of Core Media, Okello Herbert Andrew of Untold Stories Uganda, Ali Kakembo of MCI Radio, Zoe Nakuya, Anna Grace Awili, our panelists, Abbas Mpindi of the Media Challenge Initiative, and Bobina Zulfa from Policy. And to our live audience, thank you. Thank you so much for turning up. Thank you so much for tuning into another episode of Hashtag with Navguze Chwanuka. If you loved what you heard, make sure you subscribe to Hashtag with Navguze Chwanuka in your podcast platform of choice and share it with your friends, loved ones, and everyone that you believe is affected by the millennial world around us. If anything resonated with you during our conversation, do not hesitate to share with us on social media. We are at Hashtag with Navguze Chwanuka on Facebook and Instagram, and on Twitter, our handle is at HTNK. Podcast. See you next week. Bye.